outside. Nothing can get to you. If you create, you share your bubble from the inside, whatever people says, it will go directly in, right? So you're not protecting yourself. He says, whatever people say, just let it go. Don't take it in. This is how we work as a human being. So when I say a word to you right now, if I try to pick on you and call you names and racial slurs, if you take them personally, then they will affect you. But if you say, okay, this guy's just an idiot, he's just pathetic, he's just, you know, I'm just going to echo what the Quran says, وَذَا خَطَبَهُمُ الْجَهُمْ قَالُوا سَلَامًا. I'm just going to ignore you.
Yeah, I mean, that's easy, right?
Then it won't
affect.
So for me, I speak for myself, huh? I don't want to say this is how everyone should work, how everyone should deal with racism. Obviously, each person deals with his own. But since I have been through that experience myself many times, I just ignore it. And I just pretend it never happened. And I, like, seconds later,
Right.
Me
so I
is
think
me.
Maybe Aussies are not that racist. God, that's what I'm getting from this.
Actually, we are one of the most racist nations in the world.
But Brother Yasser, like, that's all cool and fine, right? Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words cannot hurt me. But what if, like...
I like the concept. I think, do the same thing, but with a different twist to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think making it funny and bringing in humor really makes it, like, you know... just
bearable?
Bearable, right? Mm-hmm. I still remember just a personal anecdote. So basically, in one of these countries I was living in, I still remember this guy passed in a motorbike and shouted at me, "Hey, pack your face, go back to your country." And normally a person would be hurt by that, right? Oh man, you know, I felt like turning around and saying, "I'm not Pakistani, I'm Indian." You know what I'm saying? Like, you make it funny. You you know, when you bring humor in something,
coping
it's so
mechanism.
Easy to cope with it, right? I think, and I feel a lot of stand-up comedians do that, right? They talk about race, they talk about disabilities, and we shouldn't be sensitive about it. I think it's a good way to release the pressure, right? Humor and laughing things out just, you know, releases the pressure. And it makes it a topic that's not important, right? It's not a sensitive topic. We are making it sensitive by being very serious about it, right?
Interesting.
This guy is being racist. Okay, he's the guy who's crazy,
right?
Oh, that's
a him problem.
Yeah, it's his problem, right? Not my problem. Now, the problem we have is that we give too much importance to what other people think, right? We're people who care about what society thinks about us a bit too much, right? There's a certain amount we should care, but this is past the borderline, right? If somebody doesn't like me because I'm brown, well, that's his fault, right? I didn't choose to be brown. I was created, and I actually like being brown, right? And you like being white, and that's how you're created. And the guy likes being black,
green.
And that's how he was created, right? These are imaginary differences in terms of values, right? Mm-hmm. They're not real values. Being white, brown, black, whatever color is not a value, right? And making it a value is an imagination that somebody has, thinking that I am better because I am this color. Right. And so I feel like people who are struggling with racism, I think one of the things they can try and do, again, depends on personality. My personality, I just like to laugh a lot. You know, just don't take it so seriously.
Shrug it off.
Yeah, shrug it off, you know, make a joke out of it and it just passes.
And remind you guys, this only works so long as it is limited to verbal racism.
Of course, yeah. When it
because
gets physical,
a lot of people are facing like... violence.
Yeah.
But that's not racism. This is genocide. So once you take it to the physical aspect, you're trying to racially eliminate people. That's a different category, different crime.
Not so much as eliminate them, but like...
So it can go all the way to genocide, right?
Yeah, I mean,
genocide
happening.
Is a result of...
I don't want to name names. We have Muslims, genocides. They're going through genocide. Like
okay.
Myanmar, Philistine, Yemen. It's genocide. Because of their ethnicity, they're trying to eliminate them completely.
So racism can lead to genocide.
It's
right?
rooted
we've seen
in
that
racism
in Africa,
at the end of the day.
Europe,
yeah, in South Africa, that's what happened, right? It would be like, oh, y'all are black, we are white, we superior. We're going to shoot you and kill you and imprison you until y'all give up. And then along came Nelson Mandela and he was a boss.
But yeah, there are some people at a smaller scale. There's people who in their countries suffer racism. Like you might get attacked, you might get your house robbed or your car.
Exactly.
Your car,
that's
you know, scratched
vandalized,
because, or vandalized because you're different color. And
it's scary.
It's scary, yeah.
When
exactly.
you feel like, especially when you're a woman, because like you guys had like your own experiences and it was real. And I love the way you guys cope with it, whether it was changing your mentality and thinking that, okay, that's his problem, not even mine, or just saying that, okay, whatever, bro, I've got better things to do. But it gets kind of more complicated when you're a woman.
Yeah.
Right? Number one, you feel physically unsafe at that moment when they start telling you like go back to your country. What is that hijab you're wearing on your head? You feel like at any moment someone could tug it off, someone could attack you, someone could, or a man who's obviously bigger and stronger than you could feel like, okay, words are not enough to disagree.
Okay, don't scare all the people out there.
Against this hijabi woman, let's do something like drastic. But on the other hand, I also feel like, you know, it kind of makes your faith stronger if you have the right
mentality towards
yeah,
it, the right,
right
perspective,
mentality yeah. and perspective toward
Look,
it.
When you talk about coping with such a kind of racism, I think it's the same way you would cope with any type of crime. This is racism that's at the level of a crime, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any specific way to cope with racism that becomes violent,
yeah.
right? It's a crime, and the same way somebody might attack you because they want to steal your purse, that's the exact same way you would cope if somebody wants to pull off your chador, right? I think this is the next level, and it's something we need to think about as a community. We need to think about that, right? How can we keep our ourselves protected? And I don't know. This is something that we really need to think about, especially in countries where it's more and more prevalent.
So. Yeah.
As Muslims, especially living in the West, I think, speaking for myself, because I got daughters and wives and mothers and sisters, is that issue that women are not safe in the street. Because as a man, even if someone wants to hit me, for example, I can cope.
Hit them back,
I can defend myself. Or at least I can cope up with I can get bashed and, you know, just walk it off. But for a female, it's different. Once my stepmother, she was walking the street and just someone was driving by and he threw an ice cream cone at her, right? And I mean, you know, it might be not much, but to her, because of her physical and mental state, she felt very insecure to be in the streets anymore by herself alone.
The anxiety
so
just brings
our up. Main concern actually in the West, being in countries where racism is very high, especially like, you know, if I say Australia, because it's extremely high, this has always been a factor for females. They're constantly harassed. And even in universities, public places, parks, wherever they might be, they're harassed. They, you know, they got called names. And at times they face physical assault. And that's even recently in the last couple of weeks, as you guys seen in India, where so many Muslim girls were...
Oh, what's happening in India is just pure madness.
It is madness. So you see so many girls, like their hijab get pulled off. And it's disgusting. You know what I mean? So... this is all as parents and as husbands and as fathers. Being in the West, this is always our number one concern.
All right, I'm okay. Whatever you do to me, don't touch my women.
Exactly. Mm. So it's a very sensitive issue when it comes to women. And I think a lot of, even because I spent so much time with the youth, even girls themselves, because they feel the pressure, they're actually taking off their hijab.
Mm.
Like once they go outside,
because women
once
are
they
more
school,
sensitive
they take it
out. Anyway.
Yeah,
so women are more sensitive toward that sort of criticism, especially regarding their appearance. You want to compliment a woman, you tell her she's pretty. You want to not compliment her, you tell her what is that stupid thing you've got on your head, and four or five times like that, and she's totally gonna become insecure about it.
Yeah, no. So sometimes like insecure because of her faith. This is one thing. Insecure because she feels threatened on a physical level is a different thing as well. So I was like, I'd rather take my hijab off rather than just being, you know, pulled off or physically pushed around and bullied.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's a serious problem.
So like
problem.
I said, it's a major concern for us in countries where there is racism. And like I said, the stories are endless. And especially these ones are getting reported, whether it's in the US, UK, Australia, Canada.
You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back to reality after a short break. So don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Brother Yasin, we talk about the Western society as if like racism does not exist in the East, because it does.
Yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, so that's why I didn't
mention the
country.
And even Islamic countries.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And it's a very unfortunate thing.
Because like a lot of Muslim people, I don't know what sort of imagined superiority do they assume for themselves that is totally against the objective of Islam, which came for equality and justice and whatnot, right?
Yeah, so that it's really unfortunate that, that we do have, and as you said, that racism is not only in the West, it's also in the East, it's also in Islamic countries. And it's a sad thing because it's against Islamic values, right? Islam taught us not to differentiate people based on their color or on their background or on their language or, you know, on their gender. You know, these are not values in and of themselves, right? So it's very unfortunate, but we need to also understand why this happens. I often feel like when we try to, in our effort to be fair, we go a bit too harsh on ourselves. Like, I've been thinking a lot about it, that why is it that, for example, in certain Muslim countries, we have this type of racism? And I come to realize that a lot of time is because of ignorance, right? For example, the media in a lot of Muslim countries, especially in villages, is really weak. There's no media, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, there's this, this, for example, ethnicity that has never in their life seen any other Shia who is different from them. Right. So when, for example, you as a foreigner come over here,
you're an absolute alien
and you're an alien. And they're surprised like, wow, there is a Shia over there. This is interesting. Right. When did you become Shia? And like, I was a Shia. I was born a Shia. My father was born a Shia. My grandfather was born a Shia. Why are you being so racist? Do you think you're the only one in the world who's a Shia? Try to understand their perspective. He has never seen anybody other than his own ethnicity being a Shia. Right. He doesn't know this, how much his understanding is. Right. He's not being racist. Right. He's just very surprised. Right. And so we need to understand what the other side is like. How much exposure do they have? We need to be fair. We shouldn't be stabbing ourselves all the time in our effort to look fair. We end up putting ourselves quite down. So but there is racism in Islamic countries. There's no doubt about that.
For sure.
And it's something that Islam does not approve. And I don't think we should associate the bad behavior of the Muslims to Islam. Right. And say or the even the Islamic system. Right, the Islamic system does not promote racism. It so happens that the people right now within the Islamic system are being racist. But that does not mean that Islam promotes that or an Islamic system promotes that. So we need to really be able to differentiate between these two things.
I think that whole media thing goes both ways. I think a lot of Western people have misconceptions toward Muslims and Islam because the media is messing their heads up.
Exactly, that's right.
And the whole thing is just so sad. Racism is one of the most ridiculous man-made concepts I've ever come across. It's like, it's just skin. Like, get over it right now. Get over it quick. It's just skin. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Inshallah, on future episodes of Back to Reality, we're probably going to touch upon this topic furthermore. Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim. يا ربي لدي أمار عزك
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك لتصي دليلتك once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Palestinians have held a national conference to mark 29 years since the signing of the Oslo Accords. Hundreds of people attended the conference, demanding the cancellation of the agreements. In September 1993, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accords with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accords and called on the Palestinian Authority to withdraw its recognition of the Israeli regime.
As we mark the 29th anniversary of the ill-fated Oslo Accords, we call upon the Palestinian Authority to withdraw from the Oslo Accords and to cancel its recognition of the Israeli regime. Today, we also salute the Palestinian resistance, who managed to liberate the Gaza Strip in 2005. Armed resistance is the key to the liberation of all of Palestine.
The Oslo Accords were meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but nearly three decades later, Palestinians consider them as a bad chapter in their history. Attendees slammed the Oslo Accords and expressed their support to resistance against the Israeli regime.
The Zionist enemy will never respect any peace agreements and only understands the language of force. We're here to support armed resistance against the Zionist enemy.
Senior officials attending the conference called on all Palestinians to unite their ranks and adhere to armed resistance against the Israeli occupation.
The Oslo Accords were a stab in the back of the Palestinian people. The Zionist regime is a cancer in the region and it must be removed. All forms of resistance must be used against Zionist forces, and armed resistance is the key to defeat the Zionist occupation.
Observers say the Oslo Accords have only brought calamities to Palestinians and have failed to secure the creation of an independent Palestinian state.
29 years on, Palestinians say that peace accords will not free their land, and it's only armed resistance which will help them regain their rights. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
King Charles III proclaimed after 73 years. His life is a complicated story. From his hatred of school as a child, to his high-profile marriage to and divorce from his former wife, Princess Diana, to his affair with his now wife and queen consort, Kamala Parks Owens. Those who believe in him say he put his time to good use, that he'll do well in his role as the monarch. Others say the king is faced with huge challenges. At home, he's facing growing anti-monarchy sentiment as the country grapples with the worst cost of living crisis in decades. Calls from Republicans who say the monarchy is classist, expensive, and outdated.
Are we really now in a place in 21st century Britain where a new head of state is proclaimed, we're told to accept this person without any question?
There's also his relationship with the devolved nations, such as Northern Ireland, with whom the monarchy has had a complicated history, not forgotten by those who bore the brunt of it.
There will never be an acceptance of the monarchy here in Ireland. There's been too much history, too much has been done in the name of the monarchy in Ireland for the Irish people to ever be conscious of that ever happening again.
In Scotland, where the Queen died, independence remains at the center of political debate. The death of Queen Elizabeth II has also revived the debate about the future and unity of the British Commonwealth, a group of 15 independent countries that recognize the British monarch as their head of state.
We've already seen many calls across the Commonwealth for the removal of those particular countries to be removed from the Commonwealth. I think that's going to be something that is going to be at the top of the agenda over the next couple of years.
Constitutionally, the monarch should be seen and not heard from on contentious issues. King Charles is known to not shy away from expressing his views on a range of topics, such as the environment, new laws, and more. He says he won't do it as sovereign. His critics see it differently.
The new king starts his job in different circumstances than his mother did. An increasing number of Britons are questioning the privileged position of the royal family. The Commonwealth looks set to unravel, and the union of the United Kingdom looks uncertain. Will King Charles III be the last UK monarch? Saeed Pourreza, London.
With record inflation already established and long-term recession looming, few could deny that Europe's sanctions war on Russia has backfired economically so far. A new poll from a top French TV news channel has found that the French have become extremely pessimistic about the conflict in Ukraine and increasingly fed up with the price they have to pay for a country which is not even a part of the European Union or the Eurozone. The poll found that almost 60% want the sanctions on Russia to stop or be reduced if they have too big an impact on the average French person's purchasing power.
Les sanctions et de façon irresponsable et anti-économique.
These sanctions are totally irresponsible from an economic and social point of view. Russia is the only one benefiting from the sanctions, and they've made incredible profits on the increase in oil prices. This is not a situation which can last, given the poor economic state of France and the Eurozone.
France is split almost 50-50 on the question of, has military and financial aid to Ukraine been effective? Almost 85% of those polled think the war will drag on for years.
Je parle des Américains surtout qui poussent. Les Européens, ils suivent comme...
The situation is that the Americans are pushing and the Europeans are following. Not one American is dying in this war, and they have all the energy they need, unlike Europe. Europe needs to say, no, war is not a solution. And if they don't say this, soon their economies are going to be smashed, and the average person is going to be quite angry with their leaders.
The poll goes against the stated positions of Brussels, Paris, and France's mainstream media moguls, but the economic difficulty of the French working class is extremely hard to suppress. There were over 100 arrests in Paris last weekend, at a protest of the economic-based Yellow Vest movement. Many wonder if the French will increasingly brave well-known police and judicial repression in order to protest an unequal economy which appears certain to only worsen. After the coronavirus pause, the Yellow Vests have been marching nationwide every Saturday since their season two began in October of 2021. However, French mainstream media have essentially had a blackout on the group since June 2019. While Europe is warning that energy shortages are likely to produce a winter of frosty discontent, the new poll shows a majority of France had already grown weary of sanctions on Russia by the twilight of summer. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Members of the British-led Commonwealth could mount a mass exodus of the bloc following the death of British royal Queen Elizabeth II. With republican movements gaining ground from Australia to the Bahamas, the new King Charles III could see his royal domain shrink below the current 14 countries he currently rules over.
Barbados was the last country to leave, becoming a republic just last year. Jamaica has also expressed a strong desire to follow suit with a referendum planned in 2025. On Monday, the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda said that his nation should have a vote on whether they should keep the royal family as head of state within the next few years. Elsewhere, Australia and New Zealand have witnessed renewed calls for a public debate on the matter to decide what they should do going forward.
Founded in 1931, the Commonwealth is a collection of countries which were former dominions of the British Empire. Following the global demand for greater freedom, the Empire was forced to grant more independence to its remaining territories. The Commonwealth Charter claims the bloc works towards shared goals of prosperity, democracy, and peace. So why would so many member states be this seemingly eager to quit? Press TV asked Dr. Salman Butt for his thoughts.
I don't really think there's much Commonwealth about it. I mean, it's a bunch of countries, unfortunately, that share one thing in common, which they've been completely destroyed and, you know, and terrorized by the same kind of empire. There is this underlying kind of neo-imperialist agenda and soft power that's being, you know, still being imposed on other countries, especially so-called, you know, third world countries, which, by the way, the reason why they're the third world now is because of, unfortunately, being systematically destroyed, deindustrialized, and kind of pillaged by empire, British Empire.
The new King and Queen are expected to launch a tour in 2023, visiting a number of Commonwealth nations in an attempt to combat the rise in anti-monarchy sentiment. Their performance could decide the fate of their shrinking royal realm. Robert Carter, Windsor.
And
Amid mutual accusations of obstructing the UN brokered truce, the UN Security Council called on both parties of the war in Yemen to urgently intensify peace talks in order to expand the truce that could translate into a durable ceasefire.
Reopening of the Sana'a airport and the port of Hodeidah fully and paying suspended salaries are basic conditions for reaching an extension of the armistice or a solution to a permanent ceasefire in Yemen. There is no longer a way to waive these conditions, as there are basic rights of the Yemeni people to feel that there is a real change and an improvement in the humanitarian situation.
Observers say the national delegation will likely reject the renewal of the truce since no progress has been made so far to find a solution regarding paying the government employees whose salaries are suspended since 2016 as a result of the Saudi war on Yemen.
The national delegation was refusing to extend the truce for the third time and did not agree until the mediation of Oman. At the time, an agreement was made regarding the unpaid salaries. Unfortunately, nothing has been achieved so far. Therefore, I think that the national delegation will not agree to extend the truce for a fourth time until radical solutions are found regarding the salaries.
The Security Council highlighted the tangible benefits of the UN brokered truce to the Yemeni people, including the flow of fuel through Hodeidah port. However, the Yemeni Petroleum Company says Saudi Arabia is still imposing restrictions on fuel imports.
Yemenis say the Saudi-led coalition has not fulfilled its commitments under the UN agreement over the past months. Therefore, the national delegation says it will continue the talks only to reach a solution that completely ends the war and siege. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Life is not yet hectic in central Berlin on an end of summer Monday. As Berliners gradually return to work, for many it is difficult not to turn on to the energy issues afflicting the country. The recent announcement by Russia to halt gas deliveries to Germany via the key pipeline Nord Stream 1 for an indefinite period has sparked fears of power shortages next winter and fueled inflation.
Also, natürlich bin ich besorgt.
Of course I'm worried. The energy crisis is a pressing issue for all Germans. We're moving back to coal-powered plants, and just some of our nuclear power plants are likely to be kept online. And the soaring price of energy, how could I not be worried?
Germany has been trying to reduce its natural gas usage by 20% to avoid an energy shortage this winter. Some large cities in the countries are limiting heating and turning off gas lights to save our natural gas. Germany has decided to replace all Russian energy imports, most notably natural gas, by as soon as the end of 2024. Moscow accounted for 55% of Berlin's gas imports in 2021, a level that declined to 26% by the end of June. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has so far met this gas challenge through a combination of measures, including diversified sources of LNG imports and subsidies.
Can Germany then completely avoid Russian gas? That's an important question. And that depends on several factors. The major factor is the ability of the states to provide LNG to Germany. And also the ability and the interest of Germany to subscribe contracts that are long-term contracts, 10-year contracts for LNG supply.
Meanwhile, German inflation hit almost 8% in August, and earlier this month, the Olaf Scholz government unveiled a new multi-billion euro relief package to help households cope with skyrocketing energy prices. On Monday, the IFO, Institute for Economic Research, predicted the German economy will fall into recession next year. IFO also warned that the first quarter of 2023 will be particularly rough for consumers, with inflation soaring to around 11%. Max Civili, Berlin.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, The regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967. So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise, and on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance, but for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis, I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly over pay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Saeed Purizep, London.
After 1 year under the Taliban control, Afghanistan is on the brink of economic collapse. This is according to the latest update by the World Food Programme. The UN body says the economic crisis wiped out jobs, salaries, and livelihoods across Afghanistan. limiting people's purchasing power. The WFP has called on the international community to step up its efforts before winter to avert a humanitarian catastrophe.
Today, I came to the bazaar to buy some food. As I checked the prices and the money in my pocket, I couldn't afford a sack of rice. I'm sure others are facing the same situation. We call on the Taliban and the international community to take steps towards fixing Afghanistan's worsening economy.
Here on a Kabul street, Afghans sell household items to escape poverty and keep food on the plate. These people say it's a matter of survival for them. They are also concerned about their future.
We are just trying to survive in this difficult economic situation. We are forced to sell our belongings and household items to put bread on the table. Some are selling second-hand items to pay their debt and bills, since they have been unemployed for months. I don't know what I will do in the coming month to make ends meet.
The Taliban deputy economy minister blamed the economic crisis on 2 decades of U.S. occupation and Washington sanctions on the war-ravaged country.
Today's deteriorating economic situation in our country is a legacy of the U.S. invasion, because the U.S. never let Afghan national economic bodies grow or become self-sufficient. All the U.S. did was to keep Afghanistan a consumer country and dependent on U.S. aid. Likewise, after the withdrawal, the U.S. seized Afghanistan's assets and cut international funding. As a result, the U.S. is to blame for Afghanistan's fragile economy.
In the meantime, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has announced that 25 million people in Afghanistan are living in poverty, and 19 million people are facing food insecurity.
Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
American voters on tribal lands are more than twice as likely to face removal. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Kevin Morris and Peter Miller and Brennan Center for Justice. This article is published under the heading U.S. non-white voters face high risk of being dropped from Arizona's mail ballot list. Here's more. The past year has been characterized by widespread assaults on voting rights across the U.S. This has been especially true in swing states where the 2020 presidential election saw narrow margins. As Will Wilder, journalist, explains, even among these states, Arizona stands out as a focal point for the fight over voting rights. In the U.S., we look at one provision of Arizona Senate Bill 1485, which was passed into law in May 2021, but won't be in effect for the midterms. The bill turns Arizona's extremely popular permanent early voting list into an active early voting list. voters on the list are automatically mailed a ballot before every election. Under the new rules, Arizonans will be removed from the list if they go 4 years without casting a ballot by mail. Even if a voter participates, but only does so in person, they will fall off the list. Like in much of the western United States, Arizonans have a robust history of casting their votes by mail. Since 2010, an average of 2/3 of the electorate has voted by mail. Like 4 other states, Arizona has allowed voters to sign up to receive a ballot in the mail for all elections, obviating the need to fill out a new absentee ballot request form for each and every contest. According to voter file data from L2 Political, some 3 million Arizonans, roughly 75% of the electorate, were on the list in April of 2021, shortly before SB 1485 was passed. To analyze the expected effects of the law, we looked at voter file data from L2 Political, which records whether and how each voter participated in an election. Although voters won't be removed from the list for a few years, we wanted to know who would be impacted based on the list, as it was when the legislature was considering this change. To do so, we looked at which voters on the list cast a mail ballot in any election in 2017, 2018, 2019 or 2020. If they voted by mail in any of these elections, they are considered not at risk of being dropped. They are considered at risk if they did not cast a mail ballot. In Arizona, voters do not self-identify their race or ethnicity when they register to vote. To estimate each voter's race or ethnicity, we use a technique common among political scientists called Bayesian improved surname geocoding, which predicts race or ethnicity based on each voter's last name and the demographics of the census block in which they live. This method is widely used by academics and voting rights litigators alike to predict racial or ethnic demographics. While it cannot perfectly estimate any individual's race or ethnicity, it has very low error rates at the population level. This method considers Latino to be mutually exclusive from other races or ethnicities. Put differently, a voter is considered either white or black or Latino. To be clear, being dropped from the permanent early voting list doesn't mean that a voter will be disenfranchised. They will receive a notice from the state indicating that they have been removed and can then either re-list or vote in person. However, many voters might miss the notification in the mail, and mail delivery is not always reliable. As such, some people might not end up voting if they don't receive their expected mail ballot. And for all voters, the requirement to rejoin the list of mail voters imposes the sort of a small cost that can add up to major burdens on their right to vote, a problem under any circumstances, and doubly so when the costs have such clear racial disparities on the Arizona bill. And this adds up to big discrepancies in the overall number of voters who could be dropped when broken down by race and ethnicity. Although 31% of voters on the list are non-white, these voters make up half of those at risk of being dropped. All non-white racial groups are overrepresented among those at risk of being removed, but not as much as Latino voters. Latino voters make up just 17% of the permanent early voters who aren't at risk of being dropped.
but more than a third of those who might fall off the list. The figure shows the relative risk ratio that each racial group faces of being removed from their list. If a group's share of the at-risk population is equal to its share of the total population, the group's risk ratio is 1. A risk ratio above 1 indicates that a given group is overrepresented in the at-risk population. And each racial or ethnic group expect for white Arizonans is about 1%, although the risk ratio for Asian American voters is very close to 1. Undermining the permanent early voting list also spells danger for Arizona's Native American communities. Because Native Americans make up a relatively small share of the population, it is often difficult to identify them using techniques such as surname geocoding. As an alternative, we use the geocoded voter file and census shape files to identify voters who live on Native American tribal lands. To be sure, this misses Native Americans who live off reservations. Nevertheless, it is helpful to know whether individuals living on reservations are disproportionately harmed by the new law. The difference is stark. About 23% of voters on the list who reside on tribal lands are at risk of removal, compared to only 11.6% of permanent early voters statewide. In other words, voters on tribal lands are more than twice as likely to face removal. These results make plain that SB 1485, like so many other policies that restrict access to voting, will have a disproportionate effect on voters of color and Native American voters in the U.S.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليكم يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Again, we are coming close to the Arba'een of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and many of us will be traveling to the Holy Land of Najaf and Karbala and performing the walk between these two great shrines, the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the shrine of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam in Najaf, and that walk, which is about 82 to 85 kilometers, a walk that is done over a period of 3 days normally, to the land of Karbala, the blessed soil of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for those who are going on the trip to remember those who are not, and to make dua that those who have not been able to partake will get the chance to partake in this great event, this great show of Islam, this great show of haqq and truth, that we are able to truly take this message of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and propagate it to the world in its true essence, and not in an essence that is, you know, accompanied with my own understanding, my own nafsaniyat, my own, you know, imaginative interpretation of the event of Karbala. But rather, we want to show that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam draws people from all around the world, from all backgrounds, from all different demographics of society, just for the sake that, you know, we see that he calls people both to his ziyarah, to his visitation, and he calls people to assist those who are coming for his ziyarah, those who welcome the guests of Imam Hussein, those blessed Iraqis who on the walk would give everything for the Zaire and for the visitor of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This is a lesson, and a very important lesson, and a very important show that the world needs to see. Inshallah, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this is the beginning of the dhuhur of Imam al-Hujjah, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajhum sharif. So again, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is a book that concerns itself with the event of Karbala by a very important scholar. And inshallah, in order for us to do so, we ask our dear listeners to stay tuned for our next segment, inshallah. Mawlana, Mawla Hussein, Mawlana, Mawla Hussein, Mawla ya Hussein,
Mawla Hussein, Mawlana, Mawla Hussein.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters today is a very important book. It is a book that many the reciters during the month of Muharram would have quoted from, especially during the Masa'ib. The Masa'ib meaning the part normally at the end of the speech where the reciter recites the event of Karbala in order to, you know, take us to Karbala, in order for us to take our hearts to that land, in order for tears to flow from our eyes. So the title of this book is Nafasul Mahmum, or what can be roughly translated as the breath of anguish, that when a person is speaking, it is a speaking and a sign of complete anguish. It's like when a person has, you know, lost somebody, that breath that comes out of grief, that comes out, that shows pain, that shows, you know, hurt, that shows, you know, unhappiness, and so on and so forth. So this book is written, again, it's a historical book that has written to show the events of Karbala, to make it so people can attach themselves to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the history behind the event and the stories that occurred and so on and so forth. The book was written by the great Sheikh Abbas Qummi, rahmatullah alayhi. Many of us will know Sheikh Abbas Qummi as the author of the famous book Mafatihul Jinan, the book of du'as that nearly every single Shia household has. A book that, you know, we need during especially the month of Rushah Ramadan, the month of Ramadan, and any other month basically. And it book was translated by Brother Ijaz Ali Bujwala Al-Husayni. The book was published by Ansarian Publications in the holy city of Qom, Iran, in the year 2005 for the first time. So I guess we mentioned the book is an historical account of Karbala, historical account of the events and the incidents that took place on the day of Ashura, obviously the history that occurred before the event of Ashura, and then the events that happened after Ashura, and obviously there's a small historical account of the incident and of the history of the incidents that occurred after Karbala, for example, the uprising of Mukhtar al-Thaqafi, for example. So this is the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today. And inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled An-Nafas al-Mahmoon, that anguished or that breath of grief and hurt which is a book written by the great Sheikh Abbas Qummi, rahmatullah alayhi, the author also of Mafatih al-Jinan. And again, as we mentioned, this book is a historical account and also some other extra information regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And one of those extra information, besides the obvious history of the event, is what is titled in this book as Section 2, which is the merit of visiting the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So obviously, as we know, many people may be going to the grave of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam during the Arba'een. This was something as seen as beneficial and appropriate to read from. So the Sheikh says, or as translated as the Sheikh says, visiting the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is recommended. While emphasis upon visiting his grave is among the necessities of the religion, it is related that the visitation to his grave is essential upon every believer and is obligatory upon every man and woman. While one who abandons it, in fact, has abandoned the rights of Allah and his Prophet, while abandoning it is ungratefulness with the Prophet of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, and is a result of a defect in his belief and religion. And the one who deliberately avoids, and the one who deliberately, is it the one who intentionally, and the one who intentionally avoids it, he shall be among the dwellers of hell. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam told Muhammad ibn Muslim that direct our Shia to visit the grave of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam, for it has been made obligatory by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the sublime, upon every believer who considers Hussein alayhi salam to be his imam. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to give us the opportunity to visit the grave of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam with ma'rifah, with knowledge and understanding of who we are visiting, and by performing the etiquettes and the adab of the visitation in order to, for us to become the true visitors, and for that particular effect of being the Zair and the visitor of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to impart itself on our existence, and that we may impart it in our everyday lives and act upon it in our everyday lives. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.